All right, so welcome. My name is Tim Guile. I'm just curious, is there anyone new here visiting us today? Thank you for coming. Nice to meet you. And how about online? Anyone new tonight? All right, so warm welcome. So Seattle Insight, this is our Monday meeting. So we'll do about a 40-minute meditation. Then I'll offer a talk on the topic for this month. And then we'll have a chance for some discussion and questions and answers. All right. So again, warm welcome to all the new people. And we're coming into joining us in the middle of a year-long series on what's called the ox herding pictures. So these Zen teachings, even though we're not a Zen tradition, we like to sometimes broaden the way we look at things through looking at something like Zen. And these 10 pictures really represent one way the spiritual practice and path can unfold. So it is a sequential series, but also we find ourselves looping back in different earlier pictures as, you know, sometimes different circumstances of our life unfold. So tonight, the next image is the ox forgotten and the self remains. And we'll show the picture in a second. But first, just a couple words about it. Now, this picture is really a major shift from how we've been working with the ox to forgetting the ox. Now, if you're just joining us, you're like, what is this ox? The ox can represent different things. It can represent our spiritual practice itself, the meditative techniques. We'll kind of lean on that definition a little bit more tonight. It also represents our true nature. In some ways, our untrained true nature, or nature that's removed from us, that we start off this journey trying to find where that true nature is. And it may look as simple as trying to find where the breath is, to learn to find a steadiness of attention. It could be as simple as that. Now, this picture is interesting because the last, six pictures has really been focused or even obsessed about finding this ox, trying to find where it is in the midst of these ravines and mountains and seeing some traces of the ox and finally seeing it itself, trying to tame it, trying to catch the ox and tame it. And finally, last month, starting to be able to ride the ox, riding the ox home. Now, this image is very different. The ox is actually not there. So this picture points to the limitations of our technique, particularly when we tend to be too attached to a particular way of practicing. Because each technique has its own way of unfolding, and sometimes we hold on to that, even after it's already done its work with us. So we'll explore some of the limitations of technique, of effort, and also how we sometimes confuse the end of practice. We forget that actually that not so much the end of practice, but the technique is the end. We think that's the end of it. Well, actually, the technique is designed to take us to an unfolding of our heart, opening of our heart. So let's look at the image and the verse for a few moments. So Cheryl brings that forth here in the room and hopefully online. There you go. So just taking a couple moments to just look at that image, this beautiful painting of this little hut in nature with this figure sitting, the rising sun, a sense of quiet, of calmness, of repose. And to read the verse, astride the bull, I reach home. I am serene. The bull too can rest. The dawn has come in blissful repose within my hatched dwelling. I have abandoned the whip and ropes. Astride the bull, I reach home. I am serene. The bull can rest. The dawn has come in blissful repose. Within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and ropes. All right, we can go back to normal. So often this first week of the month, I like to go through this line by line to explore what it teaches, what it points to, and to see how it really what it has to do with our own practice, our meditative practice, and also our exploration of the Dharma. So starting with the title, okay, The Ox Forgotten, The Self Remains. It's an intriguing title. Again, the ox has been such a focus, and the ox is forgotten, and yet the self remains. So that's pointing to that there's still this subjective sense of me having this experience. There's still the image of this person sitting in the hut. There's still that sense of I and me and mine. This is really an important point. Now, this is for those who are new to the Dharma practice. This is going kind of far out there very quickly, but we'll kind of circle it back for you. And that is that we can have very significant experiences, things that feel very blissful, have a profound insights. We can enter very quiet states of meditation, feel a sense of interconnection, a sense of vastness of being. And still, there can be this sense of self who's intact, who's present. Maybe very quiet, maybe kind of in the backdrop, but it's still this objective sense that I'm having this experience, that I'm experiencing this. I'm a central reference point, kind of this locus that everything is coming through. And this really isn't the completion of the journey. There's three more images after this as we go, you know, deeper along this particular expression of it. It's not what the Buddha talked about when he talked about awakening, about enlightenment. It's along the journey. It's a very significant piece of it. But it's not the end journey. And in a bottom line way, if there's a sense of self, there's still a level of dukkha or of suffering that's going to arise. You know, the second noble truth, that sense of self is the mechanism that keeps the self, this sense of dukkha going. Now, if you're not as familiar with Buddhist teachings, Dharma practice, you might rightly say, well, what is he talking about? Of course, there's a sense of self. Here I am. I'm sitting here. I'm listening. I'm watching. I'm too hot, too cold. It sounds crazy to talk about the self not existing. But let's unpack that a little bit to kind of bring that, because this becomes a more and more important feature as we go through this month and also next month and the months after. Because this concept of non-self, or the reality of non-self, is really central to the Buddhist teaching. It's really in the heart of that. Some can argue that's even the central core, that what underlines all his teachings. And yet there's also the reality that there's a sense of self that exists. Right? So this is the rub of it is that sense of self is impermanent. It's not constant. It's not unchanging. It takes different shapes and different forms. As we go through a day, a lifetime, we take different idea, images or identities, taking birth, as you will, moment after moment, arising and passing. And we take those separate things as being continuous. It's like, that's just me having different experiences. But as we learn to look more closely, we see that sense of self is actually arising out of something that's much faster and falling back into it. And when we confuse that, that's where we create suffering. So let me give you an example to make that more concrete. Let's say we take a person, let's say a person who's a firefighter, and she also is a mother. Right? So both of those roles have very different activities, different clothing, different skill set that she might bring forth as she goes through that. Now, obviously, when she's out fighting a fire, putting out a fire, she has all her gear on, her helmet and her fireproof coat. When she goes to pick up her child from school, if she keeps wearing that, then something's off. She's kind of identified with that. So, of course, she changes clothing to be more appropriate. At least that's obvious. Now, take that more subtly. Let's say that sense of the firefighter is really the sense of the self, the sense of you who's observing, sensing, and you hold that as being solid. And so then you go to these other activities and you still hold that identity. So I'm trying to point to something that's hard to describe. And so practice is learning to see what is underneath those roles that's actually beyond any of those roles, any of those senses of identity. you notice the sense of self causes suffering, you know, when your identity gets threatened, when someone ridicules you or criticizes you, when you have praise or you have blame, loss. The more identified you are with a sense of you, the more suffering you have. This is where we take something personal. And so in Buddhist practice and Dharma practice, we're starting to learn that there's something that's much vaster, that's not so defined, that's underneath all this, is actually our true nature. And this sense of me comes up from that and falls back into it. We start to see it's how it's constantly arising. At some point, we free up that assumption of the solidity of self and see it just as something that arises in the moment and is also passing away. And in that place, there's a level of engagement, being spontaneous, being much more relaxed and calm and peaceful within your own skin. So back to this picture. At this Dharma practice, all that we've been working on for this whole year is learning to see that sense of self, to learn to practice. In this picture, that sense of self is still really intact, except for one thing, something that's really significant. And that's the actions, the sense of doing, that kind of compulsive need to do something. Have you ever noticed how it's hard just to let things be just how they are? You know, we can see that in a really subtle way when we're just practicing watching our breath. We're like, oh, that breath needs to be a little bit longer, a little bit shorter. Or my mind shouldn't be thinking about this or about that. We're always kind of, there's something in us that's always trying to make things a little better, trying to change things a little bit, kind of that dialing it in. Of course, then it becomes much more dramatic. We're really engaged, charged, angry about something, fearful of something. That energy just comes forth. But in this picture, the person's just resting there. There's like nothing that needs to happen. Nothing needs to be done. So what has fallen away in this picture is really our effort, our struggle. But there's nothing that needs to be done in this moment. So reflecting for those of you who have been with us for this whole year, look back at those other pictures. And if you're new tonight, take a look at the previous pictures on the website. And you can see a lot of the pictures. I mean, there's this one picture, this little, looks like a little kid is trying to hold on to this huge ox and trying to tame this ox. He's trying to fight with the ox or find the ox. There's just so much doing, so much activity. And it's often how our meditation practice looks like. Okay, how do I work with sleepiness? How do I work with my aversion, my craving? How do I work with my wanting mind, my busy mind, my critical mind? How do I parent? How do I do my job? How do I be a good partner in my relationship? So this constant effort, this constant needing to do something to change is the hallmark of a sense of self. It's one of the things that is always there. And the sense of self is active. I think of it almost as the sense of self is hard to see, because it's so behind the scenes. What we can see more clearly is the footprints of it, the actions that it does. This is the impulse to write, just to write an email or a text that's a little edgy, a little angry. The sense of going for that, whatever we might be craving, that aversion. We see the actions point back toward that sense of self. This is where practice is about, is learning to study enough our attention well enough to start to see how that sense of self actually operates, how it looks, how it shows up, how it manifests. And the more we're able to observe it and see it, we start to see that there's something else that's observing it. We're not tied to that sense of us, that sense of self. And when we see through that illusion of self, as we're seeing the very last picture, we still know how to do our roles, how to do activities. One teacher, Christina Philemon, talked about this as our navigational self. It still knows how to do our jobs, how to use our minds in skillful ways. But we're not stuck or identified in any particular role. So this is all just the title here. which packs a lot of teachings in it. And some of us, you know, here listening have experienced these times or those moments. Perhaps that's part of your normal life, is that sense of self is really thinned or quieted. You've had tastes of it, maybe really significant tastes, and others perhaps not. Perhaps it just seems very abstract. But I think it's helpful to kind of lay out the potential of our practice. So when we do have those moments, we realize, oh, this is what it's about. It's not this sense I don't know who I am. It's actually I'm touching in to what I actually am. So let's go on to the first line now. Astride the bull, I reach home. And this translation uses bull instead of ox, but astride the ox. So again, looking at the ox as our meditation technique, you know, the methods, the approaches, the attitudes we use to practice. And this is what the homework focuses on, is actually take a look at what's your favorite practice. How do you actually, your default? And start to look at how, where it becomes a little limited, perhaps. We'll talk more about that in a moment here. But the sense of astride the bull, so following the meditative techniques, that's really following the ox home. I reach home. This is really interesting to think of this, that we've gone on this long journey, searching for the ox, finding the ox, catching the ox, taming the ox, riding the ox. And now we're finally going home. And that's so much how we frame our spiritual practice. That it's here we are in our neurotic, angry, scared, busy mind state of place. We have to go to get to a better place. You have to get to that Shangri-La. You have to get some attainment. It's like we have to climb the mountain to finally find peace, to find joy, to find what we're looking for. So we see it as outside of ourselves. So this is very natural. I think almost all of us start that way. But at some point, just like in this picture, we find that we're actually coming back home. That everything that we almost needed to go through all that struggle to be able to find our way back home. But that home has always been here. Now we have the attitude of that what we're attaining is out there, is out far away. And there's a different way of our practice shows up around that. Okay, I have to do more. I have to keep going. I'm never quite enough. It kind of seeps into the basic attitude of our practice. We have to go on retreats to do all these different things. Certainly these are helpful. They can be very helpful. But there's also the limitation in what we think. It's always out there. It's not what's happening right here, right now. You know, versus the attitude of the practice is about uncovering what's already here, uncovering our true nature that's always been really so close to us we didn't even realize it, we didn't even see it. And that's kind of the inside joke, that we search and search and finally find what we've been looking for is always here. We've come back to ourselves. Astride the bull, I reach home. So now the next line. I am serene. The bull too can rest. And there's another alternative translation. Not rest, the ox is forgotten. Okay, so this is when I dig into this one a little bit more. So this is really the purpose of our meditative techniques, is to learn to quiet, you know, those really the flames of craving, of aversion, to use traditional Buddhist speaks, to notice how we get so contracted of our heart, to learn to open our heart. This is the whole searching of the ox, learning how to steady our attention, how to work with the hindrances, how to cultivate that steadiness. And finally, things have worked well enough that there's this time of stillness, this time of peace, of repose, and the technique can be set aside. And there's a certain, you know, it seems to be a certain amount of time that each one of us needs, and it varies quite a bit. The Buddha once talked about it as a log that's really wet. You put it next to the fire, after a while, it's going to dry out enough, it catches on fire. So some logs have been soaked in the lake for years and others are just a little wet. And there's different reasons why, how much moisture we have in the log. But if we practice, eventually it will dry out. Eventually it will catch fire. At catching fire, that's when the practice starts to do itself. We can really let go of effort. And this is the time to let go of the technique and the endless searching, the effort, right? This is letting go of the ox. That's why the ox is forgotten. The ox isn't featured in this picture. And this is such an important teaching because sometimes we become really stuck in the technique. We don't let go of the technique very easily because it's served us. It's really helped us. Learning to let go of it, these teachings from this ox herding, it really points to a lot of the stuck points we fall into as practitioners. And this is one of them. The stillness is right there. We've gone right to the edge. And instead of surrendering to it, we keep noting our breath, keep focusing on something. There's a sutta that the Buddha spoke of this. This comes from the water snake simile from the Majjhima Nikaya number 22, but there's a raft simile in part of that. I want to just read that because it really speaks to this sense of being attached to technique. Okay, so monks. So when he says monks, he was referring to anyone who is a sincere practitioner, whether you're a monk or a nun or a lay practitioner. I will teach you the Dharma compared to a raft for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of holding on to. For the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of holding on to. This picture is the sense of letting go of the technique, letting go of the practice. Listen and pay close attention. Okay, suppose a man or a woman were traveling along a path. He would see a great expanse of water. The thought would occur to him, here is this great expanse of water, but with the near shore dubious and risky. So the near shore is kind of our normal life filled with stress, with conflict, with difficulty, with reactivity. And we see this further shore is secure and free from risk, right? So we see the potential of the Dharma. If I practice, I sense that if I get to that other shore, somehow things would be quieter. I'd be more relaxed in myself. That's really that first picture of searching for the ox, that inclination to start to see where the ox is. But here's the rub. But there's neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. So what if I were going to gather grass, twigs, branches, leaves, and having bound them together to make a raft, were to cross over to safety on the other shore in dependence on the raft, making an effort with my hands and feet, right? So a very concrete image, make a raft, go across this big expanse of water to the other shore. Right? So this raft is our practice. This raft is the techniques that serve us so well. They help us find a way across. So that's what the ox represents, that putting together all the branches, learning to harness our attention, to learn to have more compassion for ourselves. So having crossed over to the further shore, he might think, how useful this raft has been to me. For it was in dependence on this raft that, making an effort with my hands and feet, I've crossed over to safety on the further shore. Why don't I, having hoisted it on my head and carrying it on my back, go wherever I like? Right? So get across. That raft has really served you. Let's just keep carrying it around, right? You can imagine this big, massive sticks putting on your back or your head and trying to walk around. This is the whole point of this I'm pointing toward here, is that our techniques we can become caught in. We carry them longer than we need to. That's not to say that when we're in the middle of that lake, we need the raft. When we're on the other shore, we need the raft. And for many of us, it's not like we get to the other shore and we never find ourselves suddenly back on the other shore or back in the middle. So we learn how to rebuild that raft. So the monk or the Buddha asks the monks, what do you think, monks? Would the man in doing that carrying the raft around, be doing what he should be done with the raft. And they say no. What he should say is, I have crossed over to safety on the further shore. Why don't I, having dragged it on dry land or sinking it in the water, go wherever I like? The raft has served its purpose. Just let it go. You're already across that shore. In doing this, he would be doing what should be done with the raft. In the same way, monks, I've taught the Dharma compared to a raft for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of holding on to. He's talking about the Dharma's teachings. Understanding the Dharma as taught compared to a raft, you should let go even of Dharmas, to say nothing of non-Dharmas. So that's a very radical statement, that the Buddha is saying that here's all the skillful means, all the techniques, all the teachings. They're designed to get you across that shore. Okay, that shore is across a level of delusion, across a sense of identification, to actually see for ourselves more the nature of what we are, to see more clearly for ourselves the end of suffering. And if we keep hold on to even the Dharma, even what's really been precious to us, it creates a sense of separation, a sense of distance. And that this picture, this image, again, recall it, he's sitting there, or she's sitting there in the midst of this hut at repose. The ox, which has been like the most important, vital thing in this person's life, for all these images, is suddenly forgotten. It's not like they're just abandoning. It's very different than abandoning the practice. It's very different than abandoning the path. It's like you've come across. This is like so many of our insights that arise are very different than we expect them to be. We have this idea of what non-self might be like, of understanding and permanence of dukkha. But when we actually get a really clear taste of it, it's radically different than we can imagine. It's radically different. And that seeing itself, that's what transforms. And it often happens by accident, not through our will. We just practice, we cultivate that until finally we're on that other shore. So this picture points to when we hold on to the technique too strongly, we're too identified with the teachings. And the teachings have drained the moisture from us enough that we're actually starting to become our Dharma is becoming on fire in ourselves. And sometimes this just happens through kind of a clarity of seeing. We just see that there's just too much effort. Even a little bit of effort is too much at this point. An example of this is like in the noting practice. So probably many of us have trained in that. Anytime you're noting, saying to yourself something to mark what's happening. Take breathing in, breathing out, stepping. Sometimes you can note different parts of the body. Sometimes you might note patterns of mind that come up. That's planning, that's worry, that's fantasy. These are all very helpful because it gives our mind something to do that's connected with the present moment. But at some point, that noting starts to be a little too loud. It's too involved. The observation has steadied enough that we can just see clearly without having to keep adding that technique. And then that, if you keep holding it to it, it loves a little bit of tension, a little bit of effort. And we just practice relaxing, releasing that. Now, sometimes our techniques themselves create too much struggle in us, too much striving, too much effort. Sometimes that's a collision between the technique and our personality. They're not a good match. You know, sometimes I think a lot of Westerners first went to Asia to practice or started hearing the practice, there's our Westerners tend to have this kind of slow opinion of themselves, a little bit of self-hatred, a little bit of self-diminishment, self-criticism, and you throw that into a practice that might be a little bit more austere, we can feel like a failure, like, oh, I've got lost in thought again. The story that Joseph Goldstein talks about is he was practicing and just feeling a bit, I think, a lot of heaviness of mind. So his teacher said, okay, go to your room and reflect on your ethical conduct. And the teacher's intention was for him to really brighten his mind, to feel good about himself. It's like, well, I actually am living a life of kindness, of non-harm. But of course, Joseph focused on all the stuff that he had done wrong, all the little fibs and all the times he kind of pushed that edge, and he became more and more sad or depressed. And so that's an example of the technique doesn't quite match or has to be adjusted to us. That's why it's so valuable with how we, if you have a chance to work with a teacher, because they can often listen to how you're practicing and saying, okay, let's reinterpret that teaching. Let's reinterpret that technique so it fits your mind, your tendency, your personality. All right, so that is the line. I am serene, the bull too can rest. So the next line, the dawn has come in blissful repose. Okay, so the sense of the dawn coming, if you ever spent the night, let's say you spent the night outside accidentally, I've done that a few times when I plan to get back, I was hiking or doing something and I had a bivouac, usually without the right equipment. When that dawn first starts to come, it's really nice. It's nice to see, oh wow, I can actually start to see. And when you're in the pitch blackness or darkness without any lights, like, oh, I can actually start to see things, right? So this is pointing toward that clarity of seeing. You can see clearly. Light is starting to arise. And the blissful repose. This is the release of effort, going back to what we've been talking about, sense of bliss. Because there's so much effort that we put into really to maintaining this sense of me, the sense of self, the sense of always having to kind of tweak that practice a little bit. And when it opens up in this way, there's this huge release of that effort. There's a sense of there's nothing that needs to be done in this moment. There's a deep sense of peace, deep sense of really perfection in anything that's arising. It's really a profound feeling that can arise from that. So the dawn has come in blissful repose within my thatched dwelling, within my thatched dwelling. So this is, again, a reminder that this image, we're having these really sublime, powerful, beautiful meditative experiences, and yet we're still in our dwelling. We're still in that intactness of sense of self. Again, this is normal. We approach from that sense of self, and that becomes very thin, but still it's intact, even though as we're having these experiences. We don't realize that those experiences themselves start to loosen the identification with that sense of I. Now, the thatched dwelling made me think of this famous line, this verse from the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, this is apparently the first line he said after he awoke, that, oh, house builder, you're seen. You will not build this house again, for your rafters are broken and your ridgepole shattered. My mind has reached the unconditioned. I have attained the destruction of craving. So he's using that analogy of the house and the sense of abode and how the rafters are parts of our sense of identity. And the mechanism that arises and passes away, and seeing the mechanism, the house builder being seen. And back in this picture, we're still, that house builder is still there. The next picture, next image, that falls away. So it'll be interesting to see what we find in that picture next month. And the final line is, I have abandoned the whip and ropes. Okay, so the whip and ropes we can use, you know, it's simply as meaning that our effort of our practice, our will, our need to apply energy around our practice. And so this is the end of technique, the end of the sense of those approaches of, okay, I have to keep meditating, I have to get someplace, I have to find the ox, I have to build the raft. I have to swim across the shore. It's also the ending of that separation, that sense of distance. Remember the last month where the man or the little figure, the boy, it has a nice kind of non-gender quality to it, really. But that's, they're following that ox. They're actually not following. They're sitting right beside it. They're connected to it. There's no separation. So this is the end of the ego of effort, of the ego-driven effort. And again, in this place, any sense of effort can feel too much. Not from a sense of exhaustion, but really from the turbulence that this kicks up. It can be a shift, perhaps, when you're on retreat, or I remember once before I went on a retreat, just feeling I didn't know how to practice in that moment because I could see any technique I did was too much. It was creating too much noise, too much turbulence, that I wanted just to simply abide, to simply be present. So from this deep place of stillness, I've abandoned my technique, my effort. I've let go of the ox, or simply resting in that repose. And to realize that we have these moments, and sometimes they are simply moments. Sometimes they last for a period of time. Sometimes they start to transform us to such a degree that becomes more and more our natural home. But not to worry if we haven't experienced that, if that's not arisen. Because it will if we practice sincerely. And not to worry if we've had those experiences, and sometimes that seems worse because we want to get back to those. And Zen, I think they have this saying that there's a moment of awakening, and then there's this period of reintegration, of learning to integrate what you've seen, to bring it into the fabric of our lives. And that often means going to some of the deepest places where we get trigger, where we get reactive with ourselves and with others. So the ox forgotten, the self remains. Astride the ox, I reach home. I am serene. The bull too can rest. The dawn has come in blissful repose within my thatched dwelling. I've abandoned the whips and ropes. All right, can we just sit quietly for a few moments, and then I'll talk about the homework and have a chance for any questions or sharing you might have. One more thought that came up as we were sitting together. I had stopped all the energy of giving the talk and just coming back into that stillness, that quiet. Sometimes we get this impression that we have to do all these steps before we get there. But you realize it's actually just it's right here, that letting go. And to recognize those moments when you're naturally present, when you're naturally, your heart is open and relaxed. To trust that, to go into that image of this just sitting within your hut, this in a calm moment of stillness, when you seem very quiet, very still. There's nothing that needs to happen. If you start to look for those moments, they actually arise quite a bit. If you just create a little bit of space, just a little bit of a pause. So the homework. So looking at what meditation technique you tend to use most often, what's your go-to? Is it focusing on the breath? Is it doing metta? Is it doing something else? And reflect on what the benefits are of that particular technique. Each technique cultivates something. And also helps, ideally, is helping you learn about yourself in a different way. Notice, reflect on what your relationship with struggle and effort is implying that technique. When has that technique served its usefulness, and when has it begun to get in the way? To start to notice when it becomes a little noisy, that you don't have to keep, like with the training wheels on a bike, there's at some point the training wheels come off and you know how to balance. And notice, do you cling to that technique longer than its usefulness? And realize that sense of the usefulness of a technique comes and goes. Sometimes you just need to really feel, okay, I'm feeling this one breath, I'm feeling this one step. Other times, you can relax into the stillness, into the quiet. All right, so we have some chance for any questions or sharing you might have, both here in person and also online. So those online, if you want to just raise your virtual hand and I can call on you, and those here in the room, you can raise your hand if you like. There's a mic so we can hear you in online. So we have a question on chat that came directly to the host. Okay, how does the sense of self I was referring to relate to one's personality? This question actually came up last week, interestingly enough. And that's, I think it's such an important question, because we have this idea that if we awaken, our personality would somehow really be all, you know, fall away, or be there's a sense of nothingness there. Now, it was interesting, there was a teacher, I'm thinking of the non-dual teacher from India. He's the guy who did, his famous line was, I am, or who am I? That was his big point of inquiry. But he said, maybe it was Desagada, I'm confused all of a sudden, but it was one of those non-dual teachers. He said that trying to get rid of your personality is like trying to get rid of your shadow, right? So not your shadow like your union and shadow, but really your physical shadow. Sun's shining, it casts a shadow. It's just attached to you, unless you're Peter Pan and somehow lose your shadow and you have Wendy re-sew it. It's still attached to you, right? So that teaching, if you unpack that for a second, there's this quality of it's still operating, it's still present, but you see it as not who you are. Right? So you still might be a little, you know, whatever your kind of core personality is that you learned as a child, or you kind of came into this world. There's a certain quality that's still there. You might still be a little grumpy. You might still be kind of optimistic. You might be this or that. But there's a way that's not invested in. It's not believed in it in the same way. In fact, completely, it's not believed in. But still, it's the way that you express yourself. It's the way I expressed it last night was like looking at nature. I really resonate with nature as a teacher. I can look at these two different trees, a conifer and an evergreen tree. And of course, I can see them from a details. That's seeing the personality of how they grow and their morphology and all those things. But I can look with a quieter eye and see the interconnection between both of them, how they're both an expression of nature. They're both an expression of something that is the same. And so that's this paradox, that there's the sameness, this sense of unity that's you start to see is permeating everything. Everything is an expression of that. And you can also see the difference, the uniqueness. And the uniqueness is our personality. So we're not so tied or constrained by that. We're not locked in it. It doesn't define who we are, but it's a way that we express ourselves and people perceive us in the world. All right, Matt, go ahead.
Hey, Tim. I was wondering if you could talk more about what practice looks like if we reach this place of kind of being able to let go of effort. I think by my question, like my understanding is, you know, the Buddha never really stops sitting, and like all the, you know, teachers and folks I know who have, you know, come quite far on the path, you know, there's still some element of practice, and I'm sure it's different in some ways, but, you know, there's still, I just wonder if you can speak to that.
Sure. So what does practice look like at this stage and also at deeper other stages? So it's from an external standpoint, it may look very similar, you know, that the person might still be sitting and walking and practicing going on retreats, but their internal experience and how they're meeting their moment's experience, it becomes much more kind of noticing the subtlety of things, the subtle movement toward craving, toward aversion, toward identification, seeing it in a much more early way. Like I use an analogy that is kind of might be helpful is that, remember early on in practice with my self-narrative, for example, having, you know, a healthy self-critic, I would, you know, criticize myself like, oh, you messed up again. You're always going to mess up. you're never going to be, and start to do, it'd be like paragraphs and paragraphs. And after I started to practice for a while, it would start to, I would just start to see the very, like the beginning of this, the first sentence, and then I would pass, let that go. So early on in the practice, it was much more trying to reel in this whole thing versus something smaller. And it became more and more quieter, just like I am, I could just feel the impulse, even pre-verbal, just feeling that inclination. And that's that point of where the practice engages. So you're able to engage much more, you know, early on in subtle, quiet ways. There's also perhaps a more, let's see, accurate direction of our practice that starts to come forth. Because if we start to have these moments of seeing more and more clearly what we really are, seeing through the nature of self, it's like almost you start to see where the North Star is. You start to know it much more directly instead of, it's somehow in that's that big chunk of the sky, it's over there. I start to become much more direct with where it is. So when something arises, it's a much, you have more clarity about, okay, does this lead more to suffering or to our freedom? So it becomes more and more clear about where that line is. Right? And there's also, you know, deeper seeing, there's deeper releasing. So it becomes more and more of surrendering. And, you know, you get thrown off, something is disturbing in your life, something triggers you, something just comes out of the blue, and you might revert back to a much more simple technique-based practice. Yeah, so not to get too, we have to be humble. You know, life throws at us, you know, very difficult things. Right, does that help, Matt? Great, thank you. How about here in the room? Anyone like to share or ask anything? Yeah, Michelle, do you mind grabbing the mic here so they can hear you online?
Okay, is that?
All right, can you hear her? Say a couple of
hello
things.
Yes. You can't hear it out there. You know, that's for the can Zoom hear me?
Yes, you're not being okay. Amplified in the room. Just
okay. So I don't, maybe this is outside the scope, and if it is, that's okay. Just tell me. But I'm taking the Venerable Analyo's Anapanasati course right now. And so I've been thinking about this talk and it trying to integrate learning from both places. And I'm just thinking about how just in a single sit, we go through these progressions. You know, I'm thinking right now about like the third tetrad, and there were techniques to get to that point, and then maybe there's a letting go when awareness arises and concentration gets strong. There's still a sense of self. I like Rodney used to say the watcher, and I think of it as maybe the coach, you know, in my practice. There's a voice saying, okay, you know, just trying to steer through. And there are points in the practice when it seems like, I guess I expected learning about Anapanasati, like here's a technique and we do, but I'm finding as I practice that it's more parts of practice kind of fold in on themselves, and it reaches a point where it's kind of doing itself, but I still feel a sense of self. And I don't know what my question is, but I do have feedback about that, I guess.
Okay. You can stay there for a second, Michelle, see if there's a follow-up. So you start having something that, you know, like Venerable Analyo lays out a particular process to go through that sutta, working with our breath and different directions. And yet it is, you know, this kind of a I don't say contradictory, but it's this picture itself is kind of in a different mode than that.
Yeah.
But if you look back to the previous, you know, six pictures, it was very much trying to find the ox and that's all part of the technique. So some styles or some, you know, teachings or teachers have a very, you know, laid out process. and it's designed to take us to a certain place. So in terms of the sense of you, it's like those kind of techniques, you just keep practicing until at some point something shifts, that something falls away, that there's a way that it deepens enough in you, it dries out the log enough that the practice is doing itself, but then that sense of self falls away. So, you know, there's like the progress of insight has that process. You know, there's many different ways that that's orchestrated. So it's like if you're in a technique driven practice, you just keep following that until at some point something really shifts around that. Versus, you know, technique approach that might be more like Ronnie tended to teach more of kind of inquiry and kind of looking at where that self is right now, and not so like so much and much a heavy do these steps, get to here, release, and that kind of thing. Both have their benefit, both have their place.
But they don't seem as contradictory to me. I guess that's where I'm pointing to. It seems as though what I walked into imagining to be a technique and a sequence has become more just less so, I guess, just more letting something unfold and just being there for it.
Yes. So that's a, sorry, I'm trying to get the camera person here too. And that's showing a deeper integration of the practice, that you can see that you can be doing something very technically based, but same, still having that inner stillness, that inner direction, that you're not using the technique to reinforce the sense of self. Using it just to help guide where the inquiry goes. So yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, sometimes those techniques assume that we're going to still be doing the sense of self a lot. So we do that until it falls away. But if you have that sense of, okay, I kind of take that already much more lightly, and I'm actually kind of mixing, you know, blending them together and coming from that deeper understanding of the sense of self, even while I'm applying a technique, then it just allows the process to unfold in a more smooth way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And the other thing I was thinking about is, you know, the story that when the Buddha was enlightened, he was practicing a certain technique, you know, that he was practicing samadhi. And it just makes me curious. It just makes me wonder. Because I have a feeling it is a lot more deep than that.
Yes. Yeah. The technique gets us to a certain point, but you know, at some point there's something that there's a surrendering that happens. Great. Thank you, Michelle. All right. Who else has anything they'd like to share or ask? All right, everyone good? Complete clarity? That's fine. We can we'll unpack this more next week. We'll have a small group discussions. I'll do a little recap of this talk, maybe expand or clarify it a little bit, but, you know, like 20 minutes. And I have a chance for you to unpack this homework to talk about how your experience around that is. All right, so thank you all for your engagement. And you know, those who are new or anyone, you're welcome to come up afterwards if you have any questions or just to say hi. And those online, I have to say hi some other time. So it's nice to see everyone and hope to see you again soon.